You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning, and you're with Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie, and it's time for Media Matters, as we do this time each week. Joining me now is Marty Gibson from the Papadopoulos. How are you this morning, Marty?
I'm good, thanks, Marie. Sun's shining, my chickens are clucking. Got chickens?
Yes, I did note that we have new additions to the to the family.
I've got some old ones, and I thought chickens' laying spans were a bit longer than they are. So I've got some politically difficult decisions to make with those. I've got three eager young pullets who are getting pecked at by the old hens. So I've got the least productive and loudest pecking at the most productive members of society in my backyard. It's richly metaphorical. And
A bit of chicken soup in your future, darling.
Well, possibly, yeah. It could be one of those things that my kids are talking to their psychologist about in later years. But I've always enjoyed having chickens. They make your garden feel like an ecosystem.
Yeah, it is. No, they are fun. And it's just something I miss. We don't have room for them here, unfortunately. But
I probably don't. But yeah.
Anyway, speaking of clucking, there's a lot of clucking going on because the budget tomorrow. I'm actually kind of relieved that the budget is tomorrow and not today. Oh, boy. Who would want to be in Nicola Willis's shoes right now, eh?
Well, you've got, and there's scant acknowledgement in the media of what a hospital pass she's got from squealers trotters. They're $180 billion apart in over 6 years, aren't they? Because not only do they not get to borrow the $90 billion, they've also got to pay it back. Pay back squealers $90 billion. So, yeah, there's still all the same hand-wring, well, what are you going to cut? It's like, well, you know, what happens if we carry on projecting that line of trend of debt that we've been on?
Yeah, she certainly has a massive mess to clean up. And was it Claire Trevitt who said in her column around talking about how the government hasn't had a honeymoon period, and now she's sort of heading, would Nicholas get a sort of a little bit of a boost potentially from this budget? And I'm thinking, well, Claire, why haven't they had a honeymoon
why
period?
Haven't they, Claire?
Who's responsible for not giving them a soft landing post-election, Claire?
Yeah, twisting your hair into pigtails and pretending you've got nothing to do with it? She does, in the back last quarter of her column, she acknowledges that in selling the tax cuts, Willis has used the figure of the median income worker to explain the need for them is more than simply a bit of extra coin each week. The average tax you pay has increased from around 15% in 2011 to around 21% today. And, you know, it's timely just to remind you socialist Kiwis that government big enough to do anything for you is big enough to take everything from you. And we're getting perilously close to that.
And more concerning than that is this complacent desire by people that is actually okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I find really, really concerning. She also said, too, here the pre-budget period has been dominated by doom and gloom, cuts to the public sector, grim economic forecasts, recession, high interest rates and inflation that is also playing out in the real world, in the polls. Pessimism is up and optimism is down. It's like, yeah, exactly, because somebody has had to come in and clean up Robbo's mess, as you said. And that job's been led to Nicola Willis. However, strategic polling questions are showing Willis has public sentiment exactly where she wants it. A taxpayer union courier poll out recently showed 2/3 of respondents thought public debt was too high. Hallelujah. Another question showed 58% of people wanted budget spending to be recouped from spending cuts rather than debt or new taxes. Amen. If voters see the problem, they can stomach the solution for it. And I think that, and I mean, in a way, I wonder, all these public service cuts have been a way to actually preempt a lot of stuff leading up to the budget. So has a lot of the pain, a lot of the pain in those public service cuts actually already happened. So what the budget will be is a little bit more hopefully aspirational and positive. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, my suspicion's always been that there are Labor supporters within the public service who have deliberately framed the budget cuts they've made in a way as to be harmful to the coalition. And, I mean, there was that ridiculous editorial in the Sunday Star Times, which was talking about the Ministry of Consumer Affairs cuts. Oh, we've had a leak from that. And then it's got a quote from a Labor MP. It's kind of like, yeah, that's all a little bit too cute, isn't it?
Mm.
And you know, they've also got them saying, we anticipate we'll be able to carry on business as usual. A lot of the jobs cut are just open advertisements that are unfilled. The media are really running with the hares and hunting with the hounds with this. They've taken the money from the Journalism Fund and sung from Jacinda's carefully PR'd song sheet and have really didn't critique the hash they were making of things. But now they're critiquing things like, you know, as I said last week, that prospecting for $6.5 billion worth of gold. They're willing to run three pages of Green Party propaganda on that, but never really sort of have much reflection. Hey, you know, maybe if we have kept a better eye on the functionally innumerate Labor lackeys who are running Kāinga Ora, maybe they wouldn't have racked up potential debts that were four times what that gold is worth in gross. So, yeah, you have to sort of think they're still not getting. I know you and I were both saying that a lot of the really good content, certainly in the papers over the weekend, were in the letters. And yeah. You're sort of looking at that and you look at the letters and you're thinking, well, those guys get it. You must be reading those and thinking, well, maybe our reportage should maybe look at least looking at things from those angles.
Well, that's just it. And there were several. So I've just gone and grabbed the Sunday Star Times because and these are some of the topics that came up in the letters, right? And you mentioned Kāinga Ora fails as New Zealand faces a homelessness crisis. Now, I mentioned the other week that I know someone who's quite involved in this. And in fact, I've been away and spent a few days staying there. And of course, this was they picked me up from the airport. This was the hot topic of conversation at the airport after the niceties, how are you? And I looked and I went, so, KO. And he just looked at me in a wry smile and he said, all of us, we've been waiting for the bubble to burst. He said, this is not, if you're in the industry, this is non-news. You know, the what they have done, it's like that whole quiet part out loud. They have, again, using the whole arsonist metaphor that we've used so many times before, Kāinga Ora literally turned up to the housing industry with the petrol and the matches and went, let's go, it's going to spark this up. And that's what they've done.
Yeah.
So again, you know, these letters around that. It's an absolute disgrace that New Zealand has one of the OECD's highest percentages of population classed as homeless, almost 2%, and yet there's a dedicated department supposedly focusing on providing homes for these unfortunate souls. And, you know, one of the difficulties that they have is it's the quality of those homes, because no one wants to build the British-style tenements and that create these incubators for further crime. But at the same token, how on earth are you going to afford to pay and build and sustain housing for theoretically what people will require it for either in a short or medium term? There is that mentality, of course, that is set in over multiple generations that, you know, for those, the government will provide housing over a long-term period. So therefore, if they're becoming a landlord, they need to become a responsible landlord. And as we outlined last week, they are New Zealand's largest landlord, and they're one of the worst.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're dealing with people who often have a lot of different, you know, probably the most social issues of any tenants, to be fair. But, yeah, there was a letter which was noting that one builder had said that he would have built 20 different houses for Kāinga and each one had a different design. That was why they cost was 20% more than a home should.
Mm. Yeah, what is it? There's therefore no surprise that Kāinga build costs are 64% higher than the national average.
Oh, there you go, 64.
Yeah, yeah, it's insane.
An old Shane Poe. You know, the way he's characterizing, you think, are you looking at different data? Because he's saying it feels more like, well, he goes back to him about the budget, a budget that cuts into the public services and infrastructure that our families and businesses rely on. I've noticed that's a theme. It's almost like a mantra from the Labor Party at the moment. I've heard it described as it's the services that New Zealanders depend on. It's the services that they rely on. Like government dependency is a natural, healthy thing rather than something to be fought at all turns. But anyway, so he's talking about the budget. It feels more like a razor gang going through a failing business, undermining its future to pay a dividend now and only hastening the end point of asset sales. And here's his rosy view of Kāinga. The government's incoherent economic policy was highlighted this week when it said Kāinga has to stop building so many houses. It's currently building one in every seven new homes in this country and helping to avoid a total building bust. Even though it has $30 billion in net assets and access to low-interest loans. Well, they were low-interest, Shane, but the nature of the banking class is that they print a whole lot of money and then turn fake money into real assets. So,
And, of course, he opened the entire column. More than 1,000 New Zealand citizens are packing their bags and leaving the country permanently. Many of them are in their 20s, fresh out of school or uni, deciding to build a life somewhere else. And who could blame them? The largest exodus of my whānau since the introduction of the Employment Contracts Act. It's just kind of like, Shane, what are you saying? Are you saying that your whānau are leaving because you've set this fire, you put the accelerant on, you've lit the match, and you've gone, God, bro, do you like my fire? You warm? And they're like, nah, too hot, man. We're going to the Gold Coast. We're going to become Mozzies. And that's what they're doing. And you know what? I don't blame them. I really don't blame them for going.
Yeah.
And he's like trying to say that this is the current crop's fault. It was like, Shane, you need to look at the previous 6 years on this. Because this is why they're going. It's not because what's happening right now. What's happening right now is the cleanup. And you know what? I don't blame these young Kiwis for leaving. I really, as I said last week, if my boys were in a position that they were willing to get themselves set up, one of them came to me and he said, Mum, I'm going to Brisbane and I've got a job and this is what I'm looking at doing and I want to set myself up. I'd be going, okay, hon, I'll help you to pack.
Mm.
I really would. And it breaks my heart. I wouldn't want to do that, but in all reality, and you and I will remember this too, you know, I mean, being of that age through the 90s, what was the one thing that happened at that time was, I mean, you did it, I did it for a short term and ended up digging down here in New Zealand, but most of our contemporaries went to Great Britain, didn't they?
Yeah.
To earn three times on the pound than what they were on the New Zealand dollar.
Yeah, there's this dug-in Marxist race baiting sort of crowd of people. He was saying young people would have found themselves nodding along at Chloe Swarbrick's speech last week when she said, the reason it feels like no matter how hard you work, you can't get ahead is because we have a set of rules in this economy that actively exploit people and the planet for the benefit of a wealthy few. The reason that the system feels like it's rigged is because it is. Now, Chloe, remember, is the one who said, you know, the money's there for us to do all the stuff. We just need to take it. Talking about.
But also when you said the reason the system feels rigged is because it is.
Yeah.
Who rigged it, Chloe?
Well, what a thing to tell young people.
It? Yeah.
And I think that's what they're fleeing, that kind of hopelessness that these guys are telling you. And none more so than Māori leaders as well, you know, that everyone hates you. The system wants you to fail. Wow.
So do you think, just let's segue into this slightly, because this does interest me, and having a lot of family that departed these shores in the 90s at that period of time. So a lot of ones, our compatriots who did uni then went off and worked off their student debts in the UK. But also a lot of my Māori whānau, they headed across to the Gold Coast in Queensland and many to the mines. And I've still got family over there, and they high-paying jobs, better conditions, and they have done incredibly well. So these young Māori who are getting up and going, are they getting up and going because of economy? Are they getting up and going because also too, what does Māoridom hold for them here in New Zealand outside of sacred anger and continually telling them that they're a victim?
Well, they're trying to start a civil war is the most recent development. I mean, we can go there if you want. I mean, that's been the thing that's jumped out.
Oh, yeah, let's go there because this is something that's exercised both of us over the last few days. And it started out, I mean, it's the behaviour. And the behaviour in the house, that it's almost like there's a two tiers of behaviour. We see exceptionally poor behaviour. We've seen it with the Greens. But we've also seen Te Pāti Māori right from the get-go get away with things in the house that no other political party seems
to. Like bringing weapons that are designed to kill people into a parliament with a tradition that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years of not bringing weapons. And Heather du Plessis-Allen wrote a cracking column about the double standards of Te Pāti Māori in this Herald on Sunday. Starting out, the double standards that obviously exist for Te Pāti Māori behaviour is ridiculous. Depending on how you get your news, you may be completely unaware that Te Pāti Māori, or TPM, launched a personal and racist attack on Children's Minister Karen Shaw this week. There was debate on News Talk ZB and two online articles, but that's it. And I mean, the thing that's really, really bothered me is the call for a rising up and resistance with the firearms as the logo. There's a interesting thought experiment that you could do about what would happen if what News Hub's coverage of this, which was very insipid, what their coverage would have been if the story was about a right-wing ethno-nationalist movement rather than a brown left-wing ethno-nationalist movement calling for a revolution against Ardern's government using firearms in the poster.
Mm.
Do you think exactly. That would have gotten...
Well, and that's the whole barn door, isn't it? You know, if someone from an opposing political position were to use the identical imagery and the reaction is abhorrence, how then do you let them get away with it? And just to give a bit of context for people who, if they've not caught up with this, because as Heather du Plessis-Allen said, and as you said, the coverage was insipid, very little has been covered on this. For Te Pāti Māori, what appears to matter more is that sure, it's Māori, and the party believes some of her carers were Pākehā. So while Parliament debated the repeal of Section 7AA from Oranga Tamariki Act this week, Te Pāti Māori launched a personal attack on Chow in social media. If Section 7AA were around in Karen Chow's time, would she have been raised Māori? She would have been raised being connected with her whakapapa and the knowingness of her Māoritanga. Instead, she was raised Pākehā with the disconnection and disdain for her people. So in other words, they are calling her a race traitor, which is disgusting.
Yeah. Well, and it's also pretty disgusting to Māoriness generally because, I've got quite a few Māori friends who, you know, don't necessarily have the accent, yourself included, Fusky, your dulcet tones, you know, don't sound as coasty as your great-great-grandparents might have done. A lot of that wairua still comes through them. You can still kind of sense it in some ways. And I'm not of the Māori, a different species thing that a lot of radicals are, but I've got a great affection for them. Certainly, you know, I've said this before, whenever you're overseas, if I've ever been overseas and just randomly bumped into a Māori and I kind of look at them and I think, Fabe, you're a cuzzy. And, you know, you give them a bit of a poke and say, hey, man, are you Māori? They go, yeah, yeah. And I've never had more warm, happy, joyous chance meetings with compatriots overseas than I have with Māori. You know, and I'm always walk away from those meetings thinking, gosh, you know, why do we struggle at home so much?
Mm. Well, I think that's because, you know, Shane DePoe covered it. All the ones with get up and go got up and went.
Yeah, it's like refining crude oil. You know, you kind of you get the volatiles off first, the solvents, the avgas, and you know, eventually you're left with the tar.
We had a young chap staying here over the weekend. He's a very good friend of my son's. So school ball in the house on the weekend. So it was very full on. This young chap is a really good mate of both our sons, and I adore him. He's gorgeous, and he's a young Māori boy. Anyway, they were talking about school. He's in year 12. And he's a bright wee spark, you know, he's exactly what you see. He's joy to be around. And they were talking about, he was saying to one of my sons about how he's taking Te Ao Māori for year 13, and he's it's not fully fluent Te Reo, but he's not bad, and he's just adorable. Anyway, and he was saying how he has to be up at 2 o'clock in the morning to be with a Te Ao Māori teacher because they're digging the hangi pit for Matariki. And I said to him, I said, have you done that before? And he said, oh, no, Murray, no. I'm looking forward to it, though. And I said, yeah. I said, you know what the most important thing about that is? I said, it's not the digging of the pit or the lighting of the fire or the heating of the stones. It's the conversations that you have whilst standing around the pit, digging the pit, lighting the fire and laying the stones. He thought about that for a bit. And he chewed over it. And he's a very bright young spark. And then the following day when I was dropping him home, and it's just my husband and I, Mr. Marie and myself and him in the back seat, and we're heading across to where he lives, and he says, just sort of out of the blue, Marie, explain to me this. He said, I just find it really crazy that as a young Māori, they just want to give me stuff without having to earn it. Why is that? I'm thinking to myself, the big questions on the way home.
Yeah.
So we had an amazing conversation on the way home. But this, you know, this is from a 17-year-old.
There is an element within Māori, and I mean, it's interesting. You can look at what's happened to Western civilization as a result of largely renouncing Christianity. And it's been a bit like fracking it. You know, in the short term, there was this immense release of energy as the baby boomers just shagged baby, you know, just. Mm. But ultimately, we're kind of running out of puff as we've just gone into sort of more and more depravity and less actual objective truth, logos. And it's interesting to think, well, Māori really took to Christianity and understood the worth of it, and understood that they couldn't carry on where they were, just in this endless cycles of killing each other and doing all of these things, you know, trying to outdo each other in terms of the cruelty that they visited upon each other. But a part of that lived on, and you know, often, you know, in the land wars, it carried on, and in Te Pāti Māori, they have that same. The proverb is kaua e mate feke, mate ururo, which means don't die like an octopus, die like a hammerhead shark. I saw it on that documentary, The New Zealand Wars, Tauranga Moana, the weekend before last. I quoted in the last Media Matters, the Māori warrior being asked, you know, why didn't you just surrender? You know, like, you could see we were going to kick your ass. We have to die for the land. Mm. And it's that, yeah, that trying to sort of pull us all into a civil war without, and this is where the media are failing us so terribly. They're not saying to them, hey, what does it look like then? Mm. I mean, what do you want here? Do you want, you know, to return to a system where you're the rangatiratanga and we're kind of taurekareka, we're slaves? Is that how you see it? Explain it. You know?
Well, you often talk about, too, taking things back to the most basic fundamentals, like we all love our tamariki, we all love our children, we are not going to do this to our children. We all agreed on that. And it's something that Karina Shields talks about, because as she says, she gets angry. She gets angry when people get incensed around oranga tamariki, because as she said, actually, Māori, we don't look after our children. We have the highest rate of children dying at Māori
hands. Use, neglect, murder, yep.
Yeah, so you know, you need to look inward on that. And yet you see there's a lot of, as you said, there's this supposed, what do they call it, call to action or what have you for budget day. How that transpires, I don't know. I really do not. I really, really hope it's not violent, because I just think that that will set this country back. We're on a tinderbox right now. I think it will really
inflame things. Nationwide activation.
Yeah, and also just the misconstruing of facts. It's been really interesting. We got some more feedback from Christopher from last week, and he sent a whole bunch more links. And it's been great. The engagement's been awesome. And as I said before last week, Christopher, and I'll reiterate it this week, I don't necessarily disagree with most of what you're concerned about, because I'm concerned about it too. But what is actually, what's fact and what's actually happening are two different things, and that's where the disconnect is. And I listened to Muriel Newman, and she's done a massive amount of work in this space. After being an MP for 9 years, she's been doing her work with the CPRNZ.
Yep.
And she, political research New Zealand, yeah. So she's been doing really work there. Anyway, she had a great interview with Leighton, and it just coincided with the news story around the Office for Māori Karana Affairs and Relations, which I can't, well, Tiarariki, whatever the Māori name is, I'm not sure. They, of course, are another one of these departments that are fully in the hole. Now, what amazed me was Muriel talked about, in this case, the arsonist that is Chris Finlayson, who created some legislation in order to what he believed would fix some issues around fraud.
The gamekeeper turned poacher.
Exactly. And it was fascinating. But then when I read the story that all of these claims, there was a six-year period where you had to have these claims lodged over, and there was a set of criteria around would you have eligibility for access to the foreshore and seabed. And as she said, there was literally only a handful of claims at that time. And then the day that they closed,
boom, 600.
600. So that's, I mean, something coordinated somewhere there, isn't it? I mean, that's a little bit of a, things are a bit stinky in the hinaki there. So she said there was that. But what I didn't realise is that it was the Office for Māori Crown Affairs and Relations that were paying the legal fees for the claimants. Yeah. For those claims.
And you know, that originally said, and this is where, you know, the radicals have really got to be drawn out and explain to us how it is, because there's this incremental little soothing, it'll be okay, normally by pencil-necked white fellas. She was saying that Chris Finlayson was saying, oh, it's only going to be 10% of the coastline, and it's going to be in remote places. And she said, we thought that was, you know, actually quite a lot. But, you know, as you said, then there were only 50 applications, and they thought, well, maybe they were right. Maybe there's not going to be a lot. And then, yeah, suddenly you've got these, you know, large swathes of the coast have not got one, but multiple claims over it. And each, in many cases, or in most cases, the claimants are seeking to declare waitapu over it so they can just tell people to bugger off. And they are already telling boats that have parked in bays for decades, go away, or we're going to come out and spray paint your boat. Telling fishermen, you know, hey, this is our bit of the coast. The concern isn't wholly about, well, you know, what if I want to go fishing? The concern is, what's going to happen when people who are law-abiding citizens decide that the law is not for them anymore? And if all the little government-paid warriors like Waititi, who I noticed was one of the top consumers at the trough of the state's largesse for expenses, with something like $33,000 in the first quarter, loves that koha, you know, with his little skinny arms and soft hands willing on war and geeing up. These young people have already got terrible problems with crime and violence and telling them, hey, you know, the system's against you, fight it. Yeah, there's another Maori proverb to describe him, I think, which is hohonu kaki papaku uaua, which means deep in throat, shallow in muscles. Someone who eats a lot but doesn't do a lot of work. I think if you look at, you know, people are saying, oh, Maori is 17% of the population. Of that 17%, only 17% of the 17% voted for Te Pāti Māori. So again, I think we're dealing with that don't die like an octopus, die like a hammerhead shark contingent. Mm. The answer probably isn't to get angry, but it's not to run away with your tail between your legs either. We've got to have that testicular fortitude in the media to say, describe what your future ideally looks like. Is it, you know, expulsions of anyone who doesn't? Because a lot of your followers are saying that on Facebook and you're not correcting them.
Mm.
Is it that Maori have absolute power of veto over anything that happens in this country? Because that's what you and your followers are saying. Is it a completely separate parliament? Is it, you know, explain to us how that would work. Because I can think of what I'd like to do if I was in charge of the country, and it would be better for Maori kids under the Māori Party. I would be wanting to get education improved. I'd wanting to get child health starting from before conception. And, you know, if they had have done that over the last 30 years, we'd be in quite a different country now.
There was, I don't know whether you remember before the election, there was a window of time that you could switch out between the two roles. And I think now you can actually switch out between the two roles at whim. And it used to be every 5 years you had to make the decision whether you're on the Māori or general role. And it was really interesting. I think the number onto the Māori role only increased. It was quite, because there was a huge push mm-hmm. from Te Pāti Māori especially to get Māori enrolled onto that role. You had to dig deep to actually discover that their net gains were actually very, very small. What they didn't talk about were the number of Māori who left
right.
the Māori role. Most of them were aged 55 plus. They put themselves on the general role because they were not happy with the state of affairs with those Māori seats. You know, and I said last year around those Māori seats, it's ultimately the end of the day that Māori can only vote once. But we've got a situation now where the Māori seats, and I think Muriel talked about this, the Māori seats were originally created to give Māori some proportionality within governance. They are now and have been overrepresented in the House than their actual population. So now, I'm not saying that the ones that are there don't deserve to be there, but even if you remove the Māori seats, they would still have a greater proportion of representality in our House than they wouldn't. So,
well, MMP was originally going to, I guess, address the concerns that led to the development of Māori seats or the implementation of them. If you've got a Māori party and people give that their vote, you still get list MPs. And I guess their argument is, well, we want, you know, local people representing. Well, you can still do that with list MPs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And see, this is, again, the problem. What is, according to them, the right type of Māori? Because when you actually look across all the other parties, you know, National, New Zealand First and ACT, there are a good number of Māori MPs there. But according to Te Pāti Māori, what did Debbie Ngāriwa Packer say about David Seymour? Oh, you're a Pākehā who happens to have Māori descent. So obviously you're not Māori enough. What is Māori enough?
Yeah, whenever I've spoken to Māori, particularly in Australia, I've every single time I say to them, do you reckon you'll ever come back? Come back to New Zealand. Come on. Be better if you did. And they say, oh, maybe one day in a box. That's a fairly common response. It's certainly not in their nature to be seen to be against their own people, but they just do quietly slip away or slip out of the conversation or quietly slip off the Māori role and vote National because their overwhelming concern is, well, I want to look after my whānau and I can see with you guys just spending the way you are. If I did that in my household or my business, I'd be broke and looks like we're going broke. So
it'll be interesting. So in terms of what happens in the next few days of this call to action, what does transpire. How do you undo 6 years of Goebbels-esque lies and propaganda?
Well, especially on an increasingly dumb populace who's been failed by the education system. You know, and I mean, you look at those decile one. Is decile one the poorest? It is schools who have a 99 or 98% failure to pass basic reading, writing, and maths tests. That's just basic literacy. It's a way below the amount of literacy you need to not only read something but understand it, and not only understand it but critically analyze it. And that suits them just fine.
Mm.
They want a population
that become Māori,
who are easy to razz up and tell that everything bad that happens to them is someone else's fault, and we're going to save you fellas. Yeah, it's a very Marxist approach to rabble rousing and causing revolutions that result in starvation and murder.
No, it'll be interesting to see how things transpire in the next little bit. But now, before we move on to feedback, what else have you got there, my friend?
Let's see. We talked about Liam Dan, didn't we? And his milking his economics 101 for all
we
it was
talked
worth.
About it before we got started, because I just couldn't believe the headline. It literally read, "Don't worry about the budget, don't worry about the money, it's about the feels." It's like, Liam, no, it's about money, darling.
It's all about the monetary theory for Liam. He's just, you know, oh, look, if we jack the interest rates up and cause a bit of a recession, then everything will be fine. It's like, yeah, that seems kind of odd. Maybe we should orientate our financial system so it serves people rather than the other way around. There was the lady who is a digital pioneer, Katie Brown, in the Sunday Star Times. Kevin Norkey. This was a very leading article. Sunday Star Times is really stuffed.
I couldn't decide whether or not it was an editorial, because it read like an editorial to me. What was the headline on that again, if you've got it?
Some politicians are using it in a really harmful way. So she's a Māori lady who, you know, is obviously quite technologically savvy, and she ended up doing a lot of social media for Comrade Cindy during COVID.
Well, I mean, she calls a company Social Good. I mean, you know.
That's not narcissistic.
No, or Marxist at all. No, not at all.
You know, it was obviously quite a leading interview from Kevin. There's one bit where he says, "Social good only does work if it will be good by people and good by planet. That would rule out the likes of the ACT political party," she agrees. So he's actually said that. He's kind of leading. Things that ACT is signaling are not good for people and not good for the planet. So that's what she's agreeing. So she's good for the people and good for the planet.
But also, too, it's that sideward swipe that ACT isn't. Who's to say? I mean, that's the
They're
her
not
point.
The right type of
Maoris
or environmentalists.
I love this quote she has here. "While heading the social media response for the Unite Against COVID, she found social media the best way to get accurate information out to communities and to answer the questions that came pouring in from worried people. People need to be listened to. What we found with COVID is that a lot of people isolated, and social media was the only way that they could get through," she said.
Yeah.
I just, that to me is like, they needed to be listened to. If you ever read the comment sections on any of those posts on Facebook placed by her and her team, I don't think she was doing a lot of listening, Marty.
Yeah. "As a digital strategist doing social media, communications, marketing, and strategy for local and international organizations, Brown too has seen abuse, some around the COVID response, which was Facebook and Instagram based. She shrugs it off. People were scared. It was a horrible time. She and her team worked long days with no days off for 3 months through a period of rapidly shifting information. Early on, she saw a graph of how many might die in the pandemic. Does she still think the information was accurate, or did the government oversell it? I believe it. I really do believe it." She's a believer. "The response minimized the pandemic, and we didn't see anything near what happened overseas. When you look back on it, you go, man, that was intense. We had people in hotels and people were escaping hotels and there were funerals happening. It was a horrible time." So, yeah, no, she hasn't done a lot of reflection on on the excess death rate or anything like that.
Well, again, you look at all of this. You look at this story. You look at the story of, as I said, the Goebbels-esque type lies and propaganda that have been fed to young Māori, especially. And then you tie that in with, I think, Vernon Small. And, you know, there's a little reawakening with Vernon. He was talking about the piece of the report and the legislation that Shane Jones has done around sort of mining, because, of course, there's been all the hoo-ha around that and, all, as you said, the Green Party propaganda and everybody's hating on Shane. But actually Vernon's taken a little time to put all
brush the dandruff off his shoulders.
Yes, and the ideology aside, and actually read the report and look at the plans that have been laid forward, and lo and behold, it's not as scary and misleading as the propagandists would have you believe.
Well, he's kind of, I think what he's done is reconciled his belief that we need electric cars and wind turbines, etc., and the government's making the strongest argument to those Greens, you know, well, if you want that, we're going to have to dig up some of these rare earth minerals. And so he said, yeah, but the release of the draft mineral strategy last week saw a distinct shift in focus toward toward mining to meet the growing demand for green minerals such as cobalt, antimony, lithium, and the rare earth elements a sustainable world needs to build EVs, wind turbines, batteries, and solar panels with fossil fuels. Fueled manufacturing and concrete. Well, what he's basically realizing, I guess, is that they came out swinging and got everyone rocked up with the then bye-bye Freddy kind of stuff. But we do need to make some money to pay back Squealer's billions.
Essentially. And I know next week that we'll obviously spend some time digesting all of the budget, but we got a lot of feedback. As again, this is great. We're loving the feedback. And we talked about some feedback from Christopher last week, who had a whole heap of links. He's given us some more feedback this week, which has been awesome. And Marty and I have digested that with some more links. And the great thing about that is if you got the links off Liz last week, inbox at realitycheck.radio, and you want the new bunch of links, just email Liz for those.
And I think we should put in the Muriel Newman link in week's one, because every New Zealander should listen to that interview.
Yeah, definitely. It was an absolute cracker. And I've got a funny feeling actually that was the Christopher did actually pop that link as one of his as well. He referred to that too. It was really good. Hi Marie, it was truly a privilege to take part of Inflection Point New Zealand and listen to the outstanding lineup of guests and speakers. There were a very quiet group of protesters outside between 100 to 130 on the Te Papa side of the street, and they dispersed very early in the afternoon. We knew mainstream media would exaggerate their numbers and impact. According to Bob McCrossbury, the tide is turning on this topic, and we are hopeful and optimistic. We were proud to be in that room on Saturday, and that was from Shelley and Pete. And on that topic from Shelley and Pete, when I find it, we mentioned before that some of the things were the letters to the editor, because often we skim over those and we don't necessarily look at them. But it was funny that for both Martin and I this week, a lot of those letters leapt out. This one is from, again, the Sunday Star Times. Gender discussions. Having taught university courses on education and sexuality for 30 years, I follow local and international media coverage on the so-called gender wars, especially in education. So I was curious to read your report May 19 on the Wellington Conference organised by a group called Inflection Point. Your headline described the conference as an anti-trans, and the article identified two of the speakers, Brian Tamaki and Posy Parker. After interviewing protesters, your reporter accepted their description of the conference as hateful without interviewing conference organisers or speakers. Curious. I consulted the conference website. There were 11 speakers, including lesbians, a retired public servant, international feminist investigative journalists, a women's sports advocate, and a Wahine Māori group. Their concerns were not trans rights, but the influence of trans activist lobby groups on social policy, the silencing of alternative viewpoints, and the concerns about the medicalisation of gender nonconformity in school-aged children and adolescents. The recent publication of the Britain's CAS report, a damning review of the affirmation model promoted by the NHS Gender Identity Services, makes the timing of this conference highly relevant as Aotearoa's relationship and sexuality education guidelines come under review. A stated aim of the Conversion Practices and Prohibitions Act 2022, and to remind people that was Chenille's party piece, is to promote respectful and open discussions regarding sexuality and gender. Your paper should open up rather than suppress such discussions. And that was from Sue Middleton, University of Waikato. Good on you, Sue.
Good. Sue's going to be on Counterculture soon, calling it now.
And the fact that she's done that from a tertiary education standpoint.
Well, the fact she's done it from Waikato.
Really brave. So, Sue, thank you. I thought your letter was outstanding. Now, the editor's note here, the article stated Tamaki was approached for comment. Just Tamaki. Yeah. And there was a huge over-focusing on the on Brian Tamaki and his people that were there. And, of course, they were using that angle. It does annoy me. And, again, it goes back to what you were saying before, wasn't it, Marty, in terms of the loss of Christianity, in terms of the devolution of society. But when you actually look at what's happening that's positive in Māoridom right now in this country, I think what's been happening, particularly in the Christian space with Māoridom, and Brian and Hannah Tamaki and her flock, love or hate them, have done some incredible work in that space. Nobody's perfect, but boy, you know, man up. Legacy for Women, all the work that they've done here during Cyclone Gabrielle. I'm sorry, actions speak louder than words for me every time.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the social investment space that the government's looking at getting back into, in particular the idea of social bonds. I was going to talk about this on the political panel the other week, and I think got bumped by talking about Gaza. But I had a talk with a friend of mine who's a very prominent Māori sportsman on Sunday, and was talking about, you know, getting basically together a special forces unit, essentially, a lot of intelligence on the ground, and just going to a hapu and saying, you know, do you want to be an area that steps up? You know, should we just intensely look at changing the reality of your people? We don't want to take over your leadership. We're going to, as I said, be like a special forces unit. We're going to have a lot of intelligence, a lot of different weapons to attack the problem with. We're going to get in, get out with no one knowing we've been there. We'll see what we can get done. I think countering these calls for civil wars by these Muppets, there's got to be cooperation against what the real problems are.
Yeah.
And it surprises me that National haven't quite yet done what I think is quite obvious, which is saying to New Zealanders, hey, look, if you can pass a police vetting test, you know, we don't want people who want to get around vulnerable children for the wrong reasons. But, you know, if you're someone who could add something and you've got a bit of time to give to something like this rather than social media, you know, we'd love to hear from you. And we'd certainly be able to give you some missions, whether it's improving the environment, helping kids read, you know, go into schools at lunches and lunchtimes and read books or something.
Mm.
I remember loving being read to when I was a kid. I remember we used to have story time. It was something I really looked forward to. And if you just did things like that to move the dial on literacy and even numeracy, you could, you know, have some old-fashioned times tables practice you know, if people wanted it. We could move from that labor thing of maths is a major driver of inequality. So we're going to get the kids who are naturally good at maths to teach the ones who aren't, and then equity.
Exactly. It's, you know, you look at people like if you're in the military space, the Jerry Mataparais and the
Willie Apiatas,
yeah. And you see, you know, those are the role models that Māori should be looking to.
Being able to see, and I've spoken about this before, the mana of those, and, you know, early settlers talked about this with people like Hongi Hika. They just found it really difficult to reconcile what gentle, humble, polite people they were, how kind they were to children in person, with reconcile that with how just absolutely devastating they were in war.
Mm.
Yeah, I think we need to get away from this endless violent posturing, because I think it's the wrong message for kids, and you can tell by the violence statistics that and the arrests for violent crimes that it's not doing them any favours. Mm. They're better off getting stronger.
Yeah, and Lisa Naruto and Warner Rapport. Right, we have got more feedback, Marty. Hi, guys. Rosie here. I love your panel. You and Marty, the elephant in the room, of course, is health. New Zealand has stopped hospitals using any agency nurses because they can't afford the money. So all the agencies, staffing is all being cancelled and businesses are flocking to Australia. I don't blame them and the staff for what is currently going on in hospitals, and they're being told to cope. So Health New Zealand decided the hospitals don't need any agency help. You've got to do it on your own, and that's what they've been told, and theatres have been cancelled in every hospital every day. Thanks, Rosa. It's a really tricky issue. Health is one thing that Marty and I do the health system a lot about, and it's not just the agency and the nurses. It's we do not literally have enough qualified people on the ground. Anaesthetic technicians is a huge area why theatres have been cancelled left, right, and centre. We've never had enough of them. We have to import them. We don't train them here. The other one is, and I heard just yesterday around the consultant in charge of regional cancer services in Palmerston North, which is where I draw to from the Bay. So that's where our main regional cancer services are. They had a report done in January 2022. It called for more staffing, greater changes, how under-resourced the entire sector there was. And this is a tertiary referral sector. So it covers that entire lower portion of the North Island, essentially from over the hills heading north right up until sort of Hawke's Bay and you cut it across. So it's a huge geographical area, all filter into Palmerston North. That report was tabled in January 2022 and they're still waiting. Nothing's done. So they know the report, they know the problem, and it's just been left. And that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is where social bonds are interesting as well. I remember I was doing marketing for a health organisation in Gisborne probably 10 years ago, and I remember talking to one of the doctors who had just taken over a practice in a pretty deprived part of town. He said, oh, man, I'm just amazed at how sick people are there. You know, just these chronic diseases that Western medicine doesn't deal with that well. It's great if you've got a broken leg, but if you've got diabetes, you know, they'll put you on something. Whereas, you know, if someone just stops eating seed oils and seeds and grains, you can do remarkable things with diabetes. I got a call, actually. It was a very, very heartwarming call I was pleased to get from an old friend of mine who I've spoken to him before, but he hadn't really mentioned this. And he said to me, hey, you remember last December you were telling me about how you'd gone on that carnivore diet? And I said, yeah. He said, ah, boy, I did a bit of reading on it and thought, oh, far, I'll give it a go. Who doesn't like bacon and eggs for breakfast? And, ah, boy, I've lost about 16 kilos. I thought he was on the way out, to be honest. He was saying, oh, I'm not well. I'm having to stop halfway climbing the stairs, and I thought, oh man, you're in heart failure. And he said, I bought myself a pair of walking shoes the other day, and he's getting better, which is great. But there are tweaks that you could do to a population that GPs don't have time for. You know, as I said, National need to be engaging New Zealanders to help with these problems. We've got to get out of this. The government is going to do this or that for you.
Yeah. Lastly, too, from Fraser. Hi, Mary. Can you please let Marty know he almost had it right yesterday when describing our money as being worth less? More correctly, it should be stated that it's worthless.
Oh, I've told you a million times not to exaggerate, Fraser.
So that's from Fraser. And yes, and as I said, I've got several here from Christopher. Just to let you know, Christopher, we have read them, we have got them, and we'll get those links.
No, thanks for that. And, you know, as Marie said, there's little to disagree with in much of that. And I guess where we often come from, you know, talking about Māori issues is that at this point it's probably good to take a bit of heat out of it, which doesn't mean we can't openly discuss it. It means we can openly discuss it.
Yeah.
If we take some of the anger, acknowledge some of the hurt, and really get our eyes fixed on the horizon and start saying, well, what do we want? It sounds like you want a civil war.
Mm.
Tell us how that's good for the country. Tell us how it's good for Māori.
And having those conversations like with the young man that's in my son's life who, you know, what an amazing question to get. So time has run away from us again, my friend.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, we're going to find some bits of paper which had things on them that I've highlighted that we haven't spoken about. But, yeah, no, good. I hope people have enjoyed that. I enjoyed it. And I hope everyone has a good week. Thanks, as I said last week, thanks for all the work you're doing. Marie, you're doing some cracking broadcasting.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. There is a lot of work, but we love it, which is why we do it. And what we love is the fact that you guys supported us to allow us to do us and bring us back. So thank you so much for that as well.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an ongoing thing. So consider joining the Foundation Members Club and also consider letting us know what a value proposition would be that would make you think it worthwhile if you're not. Because, I mean, you know, we're all free enterprise people here, and you know we want to see you get value for your money.
Yeah, and I love the fact that we have so many different voices now. Simon O'Connor's now joined the team. That's really exciting. We're going for the last few months, and he's been bringing great content. I had a massive laugh out loud moment a few weeks ago with Cam and his buddies. You know, so there's some really huge highlights there, and you know, there's light, there's dark, there's, I mean, Wally has become an absolute national treasure with Rodney. There's so much there. You don't have to agree with every single minute of broadcasting we do of a day, but, you know, you can go through and find out what you love, and it's easy. If you haven't got the app, download it, and then just go to the replays and find out what you want to. If it's climate that it gets you excited, go and listen to Jazz Preet and Don. If it's some of the stuff particularly around gender and RSC and culture, I hold a lot of that space. There's something there for everybody. So
I'd say as well, share it on your social media platforms. If you listen to something and you enjoy it, share it. Because often I'm sure we're getting throttled a little bit by the algorithm, but yeah, often there's great material and it's not getting shared as widely as it might. So that's another way you can really help us to get this out. Hey, and if anyone has got any interest in or thoughts about special forces teams to take on some of these social bond situations, get in touch.
There you go. Inbox at realitycheck.radio. Simple as that. 2057 is the text, and don't disappear. I've got more feedback coming up and, you know, a little bit of music. I'm actually going to finish off a little bit of music that's uplifting. We need that every week.
Thank goodness. Have a great week, everyone.
Take care.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.